We are back. Dr. Jared Diamond is our guest. Bill Russell and I are with him in Los Angeles. You were talking as we went away about an increasing number of people. I really would like to hear you explore the impact of having now a population explosion of humans and the fact that we're living so much longer. It seems to me that those two variables over the course of a very short period of time, especially with the longevity explosion going parallel with more and more people, how do you see that? How are we going to deal with that? How are we biologically going to cope with such a huge change?
That really is the biggest question facing the world today. How are we going to cope with a population explosion? And let me put numbers on it. We have about 40 years to cope with it. The reason why I say 40 years is that at present, humans utilize or divert about half of all the energy fixed from sunlight by plants. By that I mean that about half of all photosynthetic energy, energy fixed from the sun by plants, goes to human crops or has been eliminated by paving over parking lots. So if our population doubles, then instead of utilizing 50% of the fixed energy from sunlight, we will utilize 100%. There'll be no energy left for wild plants and animals. And in addition, there'll be no more increases possible for us. So already there are wars today, there have been wars throughout human history, for people fighting over resources. In 40 years, there will be wars in dead earnest because the pie will have reached a fixed size and we will have to fight each other because we'll be running out of resources. So we need to be getting our population explosion under control right now. There are two things we need to be getting under control: population explosion and destructive technology per capita. And if we don't get it under control now, then my children, who are now 11 years old, the world that they will live in 50 years from now when they are my age is going to be a world not worth living in. And I say that to all our listeners with children and grandchildren.
You do maintain that one of the reasons we were able to be the third chimpanzee and the Neanderthals didn't may in some part be because we lived longer. Can I take some hope from the fact that we are now living longer and might get smarter by virtue of accumulating more knowledge and doing something with it?
That's not the thing from which I would take possible hope. Even in New Guinea societies, in every New Guinea tribe or village that I've been in, there are a few people over 80, not the large numbers that we've got here, but at least a few people. Instead, the thing from which I take hope rather than accumulation of old people is you, the media. Because of the media, because of radio and television and newspapers, we can now do two things that were never possible in human history. We can know about the remote past, hunter-gatherers couldn't, and we can know about remote places hunter-gatherers couldn't. And so we now know what's going on in Somalia. It's on the television. We know what's going on in Bangladesh. We know what's going on in Kosovo, in Albania. So we have the opportunity of learning from mistakes elsewhere on the planet and from learning from mistakes in the past. Whereas when, say, classic lowland Maya civilization was collapsing around 800 AD, the Maya had no way of knowing that there had already been collapses in the Fertile Crescent and were about to be in Angkor Wat and had been in the Indus Valley. So they did not have the opportunity to learn from the mistakes of others. We do, and that's really the main thing that gives me any hope.
So the Incas and the Middle East and all these other civilizations that rose and dies, Anasazi, were not behaving irresponsibly. They didn't have data. On the other hand, if we do not behave responsibly, we really are behaving irresponsibly because we should know.
Yeah. We've got data. We've got two types of data that the Anasazi and Fertile Crescent Society did not. First of all, we know about all the experiments that blew up in the past. The Anasazi experiment, the Fertile Crescent experiment, the Indus Valley experiment, the Maya experiment, etc., etc. We've got that data. And the other data that we've got is the data of modern science about ecology, about the interrelations of things, which are really very complicated. It's not that the Anasazi were irresponsible and stupid in mismanaging their environment. It's that it is very difficult to manage agriculture in a desert environment. It's difficult to manage agriculture in the long run in most places, and we at last, through modern science, now at last have the tools to manage, maybe. The question is, do we choose to use those tools?
You had many breathtaking ideas in Gun, Germs, and Steel. But one that has just been ringing in my head is your example of China becoming one early and Europe staying fragmented until the present moment. What are the implications you draw from that kind of monoculture, if you will, versus the stirring it up that a variety of cultures offers for making some kinds of progress?
That is something that I think has big practical implications today. Towards the in the last chapter of my book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, I dealt with a big puzzle. Why did China, which led the world in technology as of 1300 AD, why did China lose that head start? After all, China is where people invented gunpowder, printing, movable type, compasses, bulkheads, deep drilling, canal lock gates, lots of stuff. So why did China lose its lead? And it turns out, when you examine the historical details, China was unified about 221 BC. China's geography, without big peninsulas, without transecting big mountain ranges, with rivers unifying the country. China was easy to unify geographically, was unified early, it stayed unified most of the time ever since. And unification, if you got a smart dictator, is great, and if you got a bad dictator, is disastrous. Eventually, China got some empires who were not foresighted, emperors who were not foresighted, and those emperors said, enough of ocean-going ships, stop the Industrial Revolution, abolish clocks. Europe, on the other hand, Europe's geography with its mountains and peninsulas and islands, Europe has never been unified, never in history. I mean, Charlemagne couldn't do it, Napoleon couldn't do it, Hitler, Augustus couldn't do it. The European economic community today can't do it. Europe, because it's perpetually disunified, Europe consists of dozens, hundreds of experiments in technology and in launching a society. And the experiment that works best gets imitated or conquers its neighbors. That, I think, is the main reason why Europe eventually overtook China. And implications for today, there is real value in federal systems at the political level. There's real value in organizing a business, in organizing an industry with lots of competing entities.
I want to go back to this decision we didn't make, the distinction between artificial and natural, the decision we didn't make selecting population size over quality of life. And essentially that was a natural decision. There was a Darwinian quality to that because of the drive to reproduce, which, you know, connects us to our relatives, to the apes. People that work in artificial life talk about language-mediated evolution. And it seems to me the opportunity that you're talking about now is a wonderful opportunity to apply this artificial, you know, the skills that we have learned, the abilities that we have developed by virtue of separating ourselves out from natural selection and becoming in some ways our own creation, that if we will apply the things that we have learned, we have a finite chance of surviving another 100, 200, 500 years.
It's not very long.
Yeah. Well, you know, you take it one day at a time, basically.
100 years. There are two alternative scenarios for how we're going to survive. And one is the scenario that you've painted, namely we use our intelligence, we limit our population growth, we limit the impact of destructive technology, we defuse wars, and that means that we survive happily. Now, let's suppose that we don't do all those things and that our population continues to explode and we continue to clobber the environment. In that case, the form in which we're going to survive is that there's going to be, we'll run to the end of our resources. There's going to be widespread starvation. Starving people will try to take resources from the people next door. So there will be more and more wars. Maybe India and Pakistan will use their nuclear weapons. Maybe other countries will. And if we survive, we're going to survive by starving ourselves or bonding ourselves back to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. So we have the choice. Do we want to survive as civilized society, or do we want to survive as we were 50,000 years ago? And it's up for grabs. And the answer is going to be clear sometime between 40 and 80 years from now.
And you're betting?
Up for grabs. I'm cautiously optimistic, which is why I have not jumped out of the window and why I did choose to have children.
And why you wrote wonderful books. This is Dr. Jared Diamond. We're going to be back in a moment for a couple more minutes here in Los Angeles. Bill Russell and I urge you to stay with us.